If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Monday, November the 26th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. Joining me today in studio here on the campus of Stanford University is my colleague Michael Oslin. He is the Hoover Institution's inaugural Williams Griffiths Fellow in Contemporary Asia, specializing in global risk analysis, U.S. security and foreign policy strategy, as well as security and political relations in Asia. And he's doing something very strategic. I believe tomorrow you are driving across the country?
Later this week, yes.
Later this week.
Driving back to D.C.
Okay, I don't know how many of our listeners have done this before. This fascinates me in several regards. I came out to California about 25 years ago, and I debated whether or not I would do the drive. Now, I had to get to a job pretty fast, so I thought, not a good idea. I'll end up shotgunning it and do it in about 3 days, and I'll be a wreck if I survive the drive when I get out here. So I didn't do it, but I've thought in the years since, would I enjoy doing it? And here, Michael, is the strategy of this is what fascinates me. And I'll let you explain how you plan to do this, because there is a weather element involved. You got to look north, central, and south to decide which route I'm going to take. And you got to think about weather. Secondly, you're driving with your wife, correct?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so now there's a question about division of labor. Who does the heavy lifting? Who does the driving? Thirdly, how do the two of us spend all this time in the car together? Do we have long, thoughtful conversations? At some point, do we get tired of talking to each other? Do we listen to music? Do we listen to podcasts? Do we just have stony silence? Do we play Punch Buggy and I Spy? So tell me, how do you plan this odyssey?
Well, we already did it, Bill. We drove out here, actually,
right,
from D.C., and we were with our son, and we have a dog as well, and it was fantastic. It was the best thing we've ever done, I think. It took 10 days.
So three of you did the driving. I assume the dog was not behind the wheel.
Yeah, well, just occasionally, but when there were no cops around.
Okay.
And we did divide it up. It depends. Some people want to do 12, 13 hours a day. It's too much. We averaged about 8 hours a day, but I charted out historical spots of interest all along the route, and we took a central northern route, which was I-80 all the way out, and that parallels the Pioneer Trails,
right,
as well as the Transcontinental Railroad, and it's fascinating. You can stop at wagon wheel ruts that still scar the landscape. You can go to forts like Fort Laramie. We went to Promontory Point, where the Transcontinental Railroad was joined, and the Golden Spike was driven. And, of course, that Golden Spike, by the way, is here at Stanford in the Cantor Art Museum.
Mm-hmm.
It flew by. I mean, there was so much more we wanted to see than we had time. So this time it's going to be just my wife and me and the dog, and we will drive back the southern route, and we're going to go a combination of a route of I-40, which is the old Route 66,
right,
and then we're going to drop down through Texas to Route 20, and we'll go through Louisiana, and then Alabama, and then Georgia, and then we'll hit South Carolina. And then we'll turn north and go back up to D.C. And there's a lot of trails you can, you know, the Santa Fe trails. That's not this particular route, but there's tons of trails you can follow. There's always sights to see. If you go to Tucson, which we're not, unfortunately, this time, about 20 miles south of Tucson is the Titan II Missile Museum.
Oh.
You get to go into an ICBM bunker and silo, and they've got a missile there, and there's just so many things to see around the country that you got to take. We're going to take 10 days on this one, and you got to do it at least 10 days and get off the road and explore a little bit. It'll give you such confidence in the country and such disdain for what goes on in the so-called corridors of power, and it's just an amazing experience.
How do you keep abreast of what's going on in the news? You just listen to the AM radio at the top of the
hour?
Do you check your phone when you're not driving?
No, try not to.
You check out.
Check out as much as possible. You know, a couple days in, you start itching because we're all so, you know, wired in the brain now for it. But it was great to be off of it as much as possible. Do some reading if you can. Listen to local radio, and you know, we listen to some satellite radio, but no, checking out was the best thing. I mean, bring some books. I mean, you know, I was reading about the history of the Oregon and California trails as we were coming out, and then the Transcontinental Railroad, and so it's as you're going past these spots, you know, you're building up your knowledge base, and I think that's the best thing to do. So we'll read about Texas, and hopefully get some William Faulkner for when we hit the Deep South, and we'll see. It's just, it's such a great opportunity. You know, all the everyone wants to go abroad, and yet right. we have, you know, the most amazing set of geophysical features and cultural features and historical spots. I mean, I sort of became convinced on this trip on the way out that at least for the foreseeable future, I don't want to go anywhere else. I just want to go all around this country.
So two things in the South. I have family in the South, so I know this area pretty well. Two things to look for, especially when you're getting into the Georgia region. One is Warm Springs and the FDR Little White House.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a very insightful thing to look at, and you can get appreciation for how he lived with polio. And then the second is when you get over to the coast and you start seeing Civil War forts, these enormous, just ridiculously sized brick forts, and just a great study of military technology where they're building these gigantic forts in the 1840s and 1850s, and they're dinosaurs. There's gigantic brick forts that really don't serve much of a purpose in the war other than just you know, intimidation.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing, especially once you hit the Mississippi, you can do nothing but Civil War, right? So you could do the entire river campaign, Vicksburg, and which, you know, we're all so taught about Gettysburg and everything else that we don't often remember, unless you happen to be a devotee of this stuff, that the war, a significant part of it was won on the river because it cut the South off from, you know, from control of having transport, and then the Union had freedom of movement. So once you hit the river, and of course, I reread Huckleberry Finn this year. I hadn't read it for decades, and haven't done and I'm from Illinois, so it's sort of a natural Midwest thing to do. But I haven't done a Mississippi trip, but it's always such a thrill to cross the Mississippi. And again, we don't think of one of the things that truly made this country the powerhouse economically that it is, and of course agriculturally, were our rivers. And we have one of the greatest, maybe the greatest river system in the world. And you know, we all know the Mississippi, but you can travel up the Missouri, or you can travel the Ohio, or you can travel all these unbelievable rivers, and they have, you know, significance that is military as well. So once you hit that part of the country, you know, it's all Civil War stuff, and that still lives. So we're excited. We'll go through Montgomery, Alabama, of course, where Martin Luther King started many of his civil rights campaigns. We'll pass a lot of the big forts, Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia, and then we'll head over to Hilton Head, and then hopefully up to Charleston, which was very significant. South Carolina was, you know, where the Revolutionary War was won. So again, you hit another war, and it's, you know, someone who does foreign affairs like I do and Asia like I do, you don't often think of our country, and yet I have such respect now for those who spend all their time visiting the national parks and the state historical sites and going to these war memorials at home. I mean, D-Day, you know, is one thing to go see, but everything that we've got here.
Right, that National Park Pass is one of the great bargains of life, by the way.
Absolutely.
Let's shift our focus to across another body of water across the Pacific Ocean. Let's talk a bit about China today while I've got you here. And I want to go into a little unusual aspect of China, and that is the question of diversity and religious tolerance and what it is to live in China. Specifically, Michael, I want to talk about a region of China called Xinjiang. I hope I pronounced that right. Xinjiang, to those listening, Xinjiang. It's a territory in northwestern China. It's about 640,000 square miles. I think the name literally means new territories. It's an interesting cluster of land. There's Russia, Pakistan, India. It's furthest reaches of China, if you will. I raise this because it's the population in Xinjiang that fascinates, specifically a group called Uyghurs. And Uyghurs are ethnically Turkish Muslims. There are about 11 million of them in western China. A fascinating aspect about them is they have a rather exotic appearance. They don't look like a traditional Han Chinese. They look different, but they can speak Mandarin. So they're in popular supply when it comes, as I understand it, to doing movies in China, where you can play a foreigner who can speak Chinese at the same time. But something interesting is going on in that territory, Michael, and that is the question of oppression, what we would call concentration camps, what the Chinese would call re-education camps, and what they essentially are doing is rounding up people and putting them in camps, and they are teaching them to do away with their religion, and they're telling them to think like a communist, and this is the sort of thing that the United States of America balks at, the world balks at. Yet, how much attention is this story really getting right now?
Well, it's starting to get a lot of attention, but it has been an ongoing problem in China, obviously for the Uyghurs themselves in Xinjiang, but more broadly, I mean, we were just talking about the diversity in the United States, but the diversity in China, you asked about diversity and then freedom of religion. Well, there's enormous diversity and there's very little freedom of religion. Let's not forget, China is an empire. The Han are the majority. They comprise about 90% of the population today. Mm-hmm. But Chinese history is a story of Han conquest of different nationalities, ethnicities, linguistic groups, cultural regions, geographic regions, and the like. The China that you see on the map today is roughly analogous to the China, certainly of the Qing dynasty, but even before that of the Ming at its height. Mm-hmm. Roughly of the Tang at its height as well. And these have all been subordinated ethnicities or regional groups. China today, in its population, as I said, about 90% Han, which means well over a billion people. But there are not insignificant numbers, of course, of foreigners. And there are five autonomous regions in China that recognize majority-minority status. Probably the best known is Tibet. There's also Inner Mongolia. Xinjiang is one. Ningxia is another. These are regions that are given the fiction of being, again, per the title, somewhat autonomous, in that they have their own legislative and governmental institutions, but of course they are still controlled from Beijing. They have a communist party within the regions. They are a one-party state, and as we can talk about in terms of the current repression of the Uyghurs, it is mandated from Beijing. So it's a fiction of autonomy, but they recognize that these are regions that are less Han than the rest of China.
Right.
Although one of the goals and policies of Beijing has been to make them more Han over time, meaning to put in more ethnic Han Chinese into these regions and therefore dilute the minority status of them.
Right. So to the extent that Beijing has talked about this, Michael, they have talked about this in terms of what it calls three evils.
Mm-hmm.
And the three evils are terrorism,
right,
extremism, and separatism.
Right.
So do they have an argument here?
So one of the things, of course, that marks off the autonomous regions is separate religions of the minority. In the case of Xinjiang, it's Islam. Now, there's two major Muslim groups inside of China. There's the Hui, there's about 10 million of them, and also about 10 million Uyghurs. The Hui have largely assimilated into Chinese society. They speak Chinese. They have been given, in fact, a lot of autonomy to open mosques and practice their religion, but because they are seen as trusted members of Chinese society. The Uyghurs are not. They largely speak Arab, not Arabic, they speak a Turkic dialect that is Uyghur. They obviously do speak Chinese, but they, at home, and prefer to speak their Turkic dialect of Uyghur. They are Turkic in ethnicity, so they are not Han Chinese. Xinjiang, which is a sprawling autonomous region in the far west, as you put it, it was the last stop of the old Silk Road, basically going out of China, has always been pushing, like Tibet, for more and more autonomy. And here's where Beijing has cracked down, because it is a political problem. It is the question of the integrity of the state, the integrity of the Chinese rule, Han rule, over all of these regions which have separatist tendencies. And it is fueled by Islam. And in the case of the Uyghurs in particular, it's a vicious cycle where repression that has existed for decades, although has ramped up dramatically over the past 5 to 10 years, but the repression has actually driven them further into the arms of more radical forms of Islam. And there have been connections, and certainly Beijing plays up these connections between the Uyghurs and the Taliban, Uyghur separatist movements, the East Turkmenistan independence movement, that have conducted extremist activities and terrorist acts in China itself, which leads to further crackdown, which leads to a further radicalization of the young. So it is a vicious cycle. Beijing has not decided that it can test the proposition of giving the Uyghurs and giving Xinjiang more autonomy in the hopes that this will tamp down on radical tendencies. Instead, they have doubled down on repression and turned Xinjiang essentially into a police state. Right. And we're now discovering the extent of this. There was a recent law passed by, again, this autonomous government, supposedly autonomous government in Xinjiang, that talked about de-extremification and de-radicalization. If you read it, the goals explicitly are laid out, not only to eradicate extremism as defined by the Chinese and eradicate the radicalism on the Islamic side, but to actually sinicize Islam. Mm-hmm. It's stated in there explicitly,
right,
which means to turn Islam into a Chinese variant of Islam in the way that the Chinese turned communism into a Chinese variant of communism. This is to sinicize Islam. And it is draconian and totalitarian. For example, it makes a crime to not listen to state television or radio, meaning if you turn off your television, you turn off your radio, it's a crime, and you can be punished for it. They have set up, as you called them, the re-education camps or the concentration camps. Obviously, these are not Nazi-style death camps.
Right.
They are not Soviet-style gulags, but they are regimented, quasi-militarized re-education camps. It's very hard for anyone from outside to get in, for the West to get in to see. There are reports that come from families.
Mm-hmm.
Entire families have been put into these camps, and members of families who are suspected of having extremist tendencies are put into these camps. There they are re-educated to be good Chinese, to be good communists. If they are Muslim, to have Sinic features, Chinese features of Islam. All of this is essentially to destroy the independent Uyghur identity, to water down the Uyghur presence in Xinjiang, again, by moving in massive amounts of Chinese, to militarize it, or at least paramilitarize it through a huge police presence, facial recognition technology, voice recognition technology, and the enforced DNA swabbing of Uyghurs in order to create a national database.
Well, two schools of thought here. One is you imprison about 10% of your Muslim population between the ages of 20 and 80, and you put them in a camp and you teach them Mandarin and you convince them to give up their faith, and congratulations, you have brainwashed, you've controlled that segment of society. But the other school of thought is you attempt to do this to a portion of the population and there's a backlash.
Yeah.
And you just breed a deeper contempt. What's your hunch here? What path is this going to go?
Well, down? We've already seen the backlash. I mean, we have seen terror attacks throughout China,
mm-hmm,
by Uyghur separatists and sympathizers. A lot of attacks on train stations, people coming in with guns and swords and hacking away at commuters. We have seen actually attacks at the heart of Chinese power in Tiananmen Square, where a car bomb went off just
wow.
a few years ago. But what Beijing is doing is making no distinction between those who carry out terror attacks and those who simply advocate for some more level of autonomy. The best example of that being a Uyghur academic. His name is Ilhan Toti, very well known in Xinjiang and actually known throughout China, who is by any measure a mild autonomist, I guess we could call him, not even a separatist, but calling for more autonomy for Xinjiang. He was given a life sentence in prison by Beijing just a year or so ago for advocating separatism. And so what this really does, Bill, is it points to a much larger issue going on in China, this fear on the part of the Chinese Communist Party and the government of the stability and the coherence of contemporary China. The fear is not just that Xinjiang, as big as it is, and with all of its natural gas and oil reserves, could split off. It's that if Xinjiang successfully splits off, or if Beijing accedes to the demands for more autonomy,
mm-hmm,
then it's a domino theory. Suddenly you have Inner Mongolia and you have Tibet, And you have, of course, Taiwan, and you have Hong Kong, and the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping, the leader, consider this an existential threat. Mm-hmm. And so you cannot even open the door. You can't even admit that there is a door that can be opened. And so even someone as moderate as Ilhan Tohti has to be silenced completely. And you see this not only in Xinjiang, but you see it in Tibet, which has also been turned into a quasi-militarized state or province, autonomous region of China. You see it in the way that the crackdown is proceeding apace in Hong Kong, so that Hong Kong's semi-autonomous identity is rapidly being erased by Chinese inroads and pressure on both the legislature and the courts and the police. Obviously, you see it with the pressure that's been put on Taiwan. Now, Taiwan just over the weekend voted against, it wasn't a national election, it was local election, but voted against the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, and in favor of the Kuomintang, the old original founding party of Taiwan, who are considered far less likely to pursue independence. So mm-hmm. these are the messages right. that Beijing wants to get out to all of these regions, which is, first of all, on your own accord, turn your back on any thoughts of independence or separatism or even autonomy. And if you don't do it, then you risk the fate of Xinjiang. Now, on the one hand, Xinjiang is, what's happening there is secretive. The government doesn't want the populace to know the extent of its crackdown. And yet, on the other hand, it is also a warning to those who are linked into separatist movements that the state will go to all measures in order to ensure that there is no space for any type of autonomous activity.
Let's talk about how the United States plays this. There is a bill in Congress, the Uyghur Human Rights Policy Act of 2018. Marco Rubio, Bob Menendez, the New Jersey Democrat, are behind it. It calls for a special coordinator for Xinjiang, and it talks about laying the groundwork for sanctions along the lines of human rights violations. But here's what interests me, Michael. You have an administration that has an Islam problem, and I'm not talking terrorism, but just the perception that it is extremely anti-Islamic to the extent of almost being bigoted. Here is an opportunity, perhaps, for the Trump administration to side with the Muslim cause, to defend someone's right to practice Islam. So why isn't Mike Pompeo or the new UN ambassador, why isn't somebody standing up and making noise about this?
They have, Bill. I mean, the question is, have they made enough noise?
Right.
But there have been statements about this and condemnation of it. Look, China reacts very badly mm-hmm. to any condemnation of any of its policies
right.
at home or abroad. This is a particularly sensitive one, but the U.S. often condemns Chinese actions, not necessarily as much as we'd like, and maybe not in the all of the fora that we would like, but still it does so, and it's done so with the Uyghurs and with Xinjiang. But it really is a very internal issue. Now, you know, if you are, if you put human rights at the center of, or close to the center of U.S. foreign policy, then it makes eminent sense
right.
to be advocating for some type of U.S. response to this, be it sanctions or something else, in the same way that we would with, you know, oppression of the Kurds in Iraq and Turkey, or name your, you know, your oppressed minority group, the Rohingya in Myanmar, for example. Mm-hmm. The effect that you're going to have is pretty minimal.
Right.
I mean, it's really not going to change anything that the Chinese do in sanctions. I mean, Trump's already sanctioning, you know, putting tariffs on massive amounts of Chinese goods.
Right.
So what exactly are we going to sanction? And I'm not saying don't do it, yeah. But the recognition that this is probably not really going to have an impact has to be foremost in your calculations, which then means what you're doing is you're taking
right.
a moral stand. And you certainly can do that, but I think there is an argument that has to be made, or at least a discussion that has to be had
yeah.
on how far we condemn
right.
the actions inside domestic situations, be it China or somewhere else, and put that in the balance of the broader sets of issues that we're trying to achieve
right.
with those countries.
My point is that there's there's degrees of volume in Washington. And sure. Let's say you're the president of the United States and President Auslan wants to talk about Tibet. Well, President Auslan can issue a proclamation calling for a free Tibet. Right. President Auslan can have a movie screening and we can watch, you know, 7 years in Tibet with Brad Pitt. Or you can invite the Dalai Lama to the Oval Office and shake his hand and do something very publicly and really put a thumb in the eye of China if you want to.
And not have him come in and out through the back door the way that the Obama administration did.
Precisely. So there are degrees of volume here. But in this case, can you argue that, well, there's really not a strategic concern here for the United States?
Well, it's a very, I think there is a strategic concern. It's a very complicated issue. On the one hand, this is not just an internal domestic problem for China. It's a geopolitical problem.
Okay, so it's a large issue than just human rights and freedom of religion.
It is, because for China, there's a couple of different things that go into this. Number one, Xinjiang sits squarely along the Belt and Road mm-hmm. that Xi Jinping is trying to build. It's an access point to Central Asia. Mm-hmm. It's an access point up into Russia. And so from Beijing's perspective, of course, if you have an independent Xinjiang for some reason, however that might come about, this basically is a block against your ability to extend the Belt and Road into Central Asia and throughout Eurasia. That's one angle. A second angle, of course, is the question of Xinjiang's ties with the larger Islamic world and the radical Islamist world. And here, I don't think the U.S. should be abetting radical Islamists. I don't think we should be going into league with the Taliban in order to help free Xinjiang. Mm-hmm. But there is a question of whether you could drive some wedges between China and the larger Islamic world by promoting the issue of the Uyghurs and of Xinjiang. This is a significant human rights issue. I mean, my former comments, I didn't mean to downplay the idea that we don't get involved, but we do have to recognize that from Beijing's perspective, this is a purely internal issue. From a geopolitical perspective, it's actually not. Mm-hmm. And so you have to think about, well, what's your approach? Do you start leaguing or going into league with, for example, the Arab League or the World Islamic Congress or whatever they happen to have, to raise the issue of the Uyghurs? I don't think it's going to put much of a dent into Beijing's policies, unlike, for example, pressure on Burma over the Rohingya, because Burma is much weaker, it's more isolated, it's more dependent on aid from the West, or at least trade relations, and so you could possibly do that. You know, do you want to approach this as a geopolitical issue? Do you want to approach it as a human rights issue? Do you want to approach it as sort of a domestic issue in that we hope China learns that it should be nice to all its minorities? I mean, there's a lot of different angles that you want to come into this.
So how should the Trump administration approach this then?
Well, I think first and foremost, it is the human rights issue is the easiest thing to raise. It's also probably the least effective. I mean, what are you going to do?
You just condemn, right?
Yeah, you can condemn it. We can have resolutions in Congress. Mm-hmm. The question of sanctions is a more difficult one, and of course those have to be implemented by the administration. Administrations can always figure out how they want to implement sanctions. What do you want to do? We've been very hesitant to sanction Chinese. We've just gotten to the point of putting sanctions on some of the cyber criminals in China, you know, after decades of cyber malfeasance and cyber attacks and the like. So now, who do you want to target? How do you want to target them? I'm not saying you don't do it. I think, ironically, if this had been happening under the Obama administration, it would be potentially a much bigger issue in the sense of going forward with sanctions or condemnation or the like, because the general thrust of the Obama administration until the end of its time was really to try to get along with China. That's not the case of Trump. So in a way, it might even be easier now, because you've already loaded on with tariffs, you've loaded on with other types of actions against the Chinese, and certainly the rhetoric. So this could just be a part, in a sense, of a much broader, united front, so to speak, against the Chinese for what they're doing. And in a sense, because of that, I think it'll be even less effective. The Chinese are just, they're just absorbing all of these body blows from the Trump administration. And so one more is, I don't think, going to be the one that causes them to, give up and throw the towel into the ring. But from the American perspective, we've already gone down the road of saying enough is enough with China. And this is just one more variant of that. This right. enough is enough on abuses of human rights. And that's, I think, the easiest way to go to it. If you were, if you were a little more daring, you might start thinking about how you would be reaching out to not radical Islamic groups, but moderate Islamic groups to try to get global condemnation of China, or maybe, I mean, if you could possibly do this, some type of global boycott of China over the Uyghur situation. But let's not forget, much of the, certainly the Arab world and the Islamic world, does not come to the aid of its oppressed co-religionists in many cases. I mean, much of the Arab world just wants the Palestinians to go away. They use it as a cudgel to beat the Israelis and, right. and the Americans with, but none of the Arab states want any of the Palestinians there.
Folks, my apologies for the Mike Oslin interview ending abruptly like that, but we had a technical glitch here on the Stanford studio, and unfortunately in the process we lost about 10 really fascinating minutes from him on religion in China, the rise of Christianity. It's about a 5% Christian population in China that's going to grow to about 20% very soon, and what this means for a regime that is not crazy about religion, that has diversity but does not celebrate multiculturalism, and what happens when people learn a faith that is about a higher authority that's not the government and a belief system that's not edicts coming from a government. So we'll have Michael back on the podcast soon, and we'll talk about that and much more, because never a dull moment on the other side of the Pacific Rim. So my apologies for that ending sooner. Silicon Valley, it seems, we still struggle with technology here, but my apologies. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to download it, and have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, please sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Michael Oslin and his Hoover's fellows to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst, that's @HooverInst. Michael Oslin is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @MichaelOslin. You spell that MichaelAuslin, @MichaelOslin. There's more than one Michael Oslin on Twitter, so look for the feed that has the words "The Old Northwesterner." For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45, hopefully an installment that works completely. Until then, take care, and always, thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dower for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.